Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayen Deng-Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Tuesday, October 15th, 2019. This year's Nobel Peace Prize winner hails peace talks between Sudanese government officials and rebel leaders now underway in Juba.
Today's meeting is also another important development that demonstrates the readiness of Sudanese parties for peace and reconciliation.
And a man whose son was injured in Khartoum's crackdown says Sudan's military leaders should face their day in court.
As an eyewitness, I have seen armed soldiers in military uniform on military pickups, and these are the people who shot and killed protesters. And we believe they were ordered by the military council.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The Juba-sponsored peace talks between the transitional Sudanese government, the Sudanese Revolutionary Front, SPLM North, and other rebel groups operating in Sudan resumed in Juba this week. Waki Simon Mudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed Ali, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni, Egyptian Prime Minister Mustafa Makbouli, head of Sudan's Sovereign Council, Lieutenant General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, as well as representatives from Saudi Arabia and South Africa attended the start of the talks. Speaking at the launch of the peace talks, President Salva Kiir, who initiated the Sudanese peace talks, said it was time for authorities in Khartoum and the various rebel groups fighting the government to silence the guns.
Our own experience, as all of us know, has shown that no one side to any political conflict can win through the barrel of a gun, but more successfully through political dialogue, negotiation, and compromises.
President Kiir says Juba's offer to mediate the peace talks dates back to the signing of the 2005 Comprehensive Peace Agreement, or CPA, which led to South Sudan's independence in 2011. He says his desire to help end the conflict in Sudan is aimed at ensuring that the two neighbors enjoy lasting peace and stability. Kiir is calling on all the parties and regional leaders to help make the necessary compromises to reach a comprehensive peace deal.
Your Excellencies, again and again, I urge you all to join hands with us to achieve the noble goal of peace in the Sudan. Sudan should not be left out in this new spirit of restoring peace back in the region. And the entire world, as you may agree with us, that if there is no peace and stability in Sudan, there will be no peace in the whole region.
Ugandan President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni, who also arrived in Juba yesterday to participate in the launch of the talks, called on the Sudanese government and the rebel groups to address the root causes of the various conflicts in the country.
Well, you see, managing society is like being a doctor. If you are a doctor and you do a wrong diagnosis of a patient, that patient will never get cured. Because the wrong diagnosis will lead you to a wrong prescription.
Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed Ali, who recently won the Nobel Peace Prize for his work in ending tensions with neighboring Eritrea, also arrived in Juba yesterday to participate in the launching of the talks. He says he is hoping to see a comprehensive peace deal reached between the two sides.
Today's meeting is also another important development that demonstrates the readiness of Sudanese parties for peace and reconciliation. With all parties committed to peace, the potential for the Sudan to shift its focus and energy towards building a strong economy that will pave the path for a prosperous nation is important.
General Abdal Aziz Al-Hilu, who represents a Sudanese rebel group at the talks, says opposition groups welcome the peace process. He says the opposition groups felt it is worth trying a different mediator after the African Union held 22 rounds of peace talks between the rebel groups and the Sudanese government in the last 8 years, but failed to resolve the problem.
We also believe that the success of the negotiations to bring an end to the war in Sudan depends on addressing the root causes of the problem that can be summarized in the two issues of national identity and relationship between religion and state.
The head of Sudan's Sovereign Council, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, also present at the talks, says he welcomes the Juba-led peace talks, saying it gives an opportunity to end years-long hostilities between the Sudanese government and rebel groups.
All our brothers in the SPLM North and the Sudan Revolutionary Front and all the other parties, it's time we end these problems all together at once. We want to thank Juba for these mediation efforts because they are the right people to help us address this problem.
The talks are expected to last for 2 months. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
A Sudanese university student is petitioning Sudan's constitutional court to lift immunity for military leaders on the Sovereign Council. The student's father says the family wants the right to sue individuals accused of taking part in the killing and wounding of protesters during the June 3rd crackdown. Michael Atit has this report for VOA from Khartoum.
The petition was presented through a lawyer to the Sudan's constitutional court in Khartoum. According to a copy of the petition, the family of 20-year-old Muhammad al-Mushtaba, who was shot twice in the leg on June 3rd, say they want immunity lifted from the council members, General Abdel Fattah Burhan, chairman of the Sovereign Council, General Muhammad Hamdan Dagalo, also known as Himeti, General Shamsuddin Kabashi, and General Yasir Al-Atta, for allegedly ordering armed security to shoot at the peaceful protesters. Amara Sajjad, Muhammad's father, says his son is unable to continue his first year of engineering at Ribad University in Khartoum because of his injury. Speaking in Arabic, as Sajjad says, all four individuals played a key role in ordering security to shoot at the protesters when they led the military council.
As an eyewitness, I have seen armed soldiers in military uniform on military pickups, and these are the people who shot and killed protesters. And we believe they were ordered by the military council, so they should be held responsible. Let them come and defend themselves before a court of law, and whatever is said by the court, we will accept it.
As Sajjad says, in solidarity with hundreds of other family members who lost their loved ones, they want to see the country's judiciary to apply the theme of the Sudan's revolution, which calls for freedom, peace, and justice.
Even though we are talking about our particular case, we do keep in mind many other cases that occurred. But because of the legal procedures which calls for evidence, we only mention our case. In reality, we are raising awareness of all other victims to speak up.
As the judge says, if the Sudanese court fails to try those four individuals, they can still proceed with their case to the International Criminal Court, or ICC, because the atrocities committed constitute a human rights violation. Ahmad Musa Omar, a lawyer who helped write the petition, describes the move as a test for the judiciary system in Sudan. Speaking in Arabic, Musa says he followed the normal procedure of constitutional document, which stipulates lifting immunity on members of the Sovereign Council.
According to the document, the lifting immunity is supposed to be lifted by the Legislative Council. But till it's formed, the Constitutional Court is fully responsible on that. It has all the authorities to follow this matter.
Musa believes this petition will test the credibility of Sudan's new judiciary, in which it says it will protect the justice and equality of all people of Sudan before the law.
We are pursuing two things. First of all, access to justice, and the second thing is that we want to test the credibility of the concerned institutions to implement the law and the document. We wanted to see if they are ready and serious to implement the rule of law in the country.
Hundreds of peaceful protesters were killed and dozens injured during the crackdown on the sit-in in front of the military headquarters in Khartoum on June 3rd. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
The remains of 28 of 32 Kenyans who died in the crash of Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 in March have arrived in Nairobi. One of the families waiting for the remains for burial rites was that of 34-year-old Abdullahi Ibrahim. Rael Lambor has the details from Nairobi.
An Ethiopian Airlines plane carrying the remains of 28 of the 32 deceased Kenyans landed at the Jomo Kenyatta International Airport early Monday morning. Hearses lined up at the VIP section of the airport as family members streamed in. A somber mood engulfed the airport as victims' families, most dressed in black, anxiously waited to receive their loved ones. Among the families at the airport was that of 34-year-old Abdullahi Ibrahim, who worked for a dairy company in Saudi Arabia and was on his way home for vacation when he died in the crash. Kenya's Cabinet Secretary for Foreign Affairs, Monica Juma, was among the top government officials greeting the families.
We have had a chance to meet with the families. We've had a chance to give them a final service, interdenominational service, so that they can bring closure to 7 months of grieving, of sorrow, of sadness.
She said all the bodies of Kenyans killed in the crash have been accounted for. The four bodies not returned Monday were either cremated or interred privately by their families. After prayers at the airport Monday, Abdullahi's remains, plus those of the 27 others, were turned over to family members. 3 hours later, a funeral was held at Abdullahi's home in the Kibera section of Nairobi. His friends carried his casket to the Muslim cemetery as they marched the same streets where they played football as children. His clearly distraught father, Ibrahim Mohammed, said that now he could probably start to heal.
Kwa hakika, kwa hii miezi saba yote nilikuwa nimekuwa traumatized.
He says, for these 7 months, I have been traumatized. When they handed over my son's body, I was thankful and felt some relief because that's my son and have buried him now. So I feel relieved and I believe now my health will start to improve. Imam Ahmed Idris led the prayers at Ibrahim's send-off.
Tunamshukuru Mwenyezi Mungu amejalia kuletwa na kulazwa.
He says, we thank God that Ibrahim's remains are home. And he is now buried next to his grandparents and great-great-grandparents. Now the parents can finally have peace because their son is buried here next to his family and according to what the Muslim religion dictates. A total of 157 people died when the Boeing 737 MAX aircraft crashed on March 10th in the town of Bishoftu. Last month, Boeing announced it had set up a $50 million fund to compensate victims of the crash and another one involving the 737 MAX in Indonesia last year. All 737 MAX planes remain grounded while the company investigates reports that faulty sensors were to blame for both tragedies. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A UN agency is sounding the alarm about acute malnutrition in South Sudan. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how do you rate the level of healthcare available in your community?
Though the government is trying to increase the level of the health care, but we still see some loopholes and some level standards whereby most people don't get exactly what they should get from the health centers and health facilities.
I think the level of healthcare is varying from district to district, from region to region. But I've been to worst case scenarios where even women cannot give birth in hospitals. We have a lot of doctors graduating out of medical school every year. The question is, where do they go?
So I think accessibility to health services in my village is really awesome.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus, and it's time for our Tuesday Health segment. And today, we're talking about acute malnutrition in South Sudan. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, in South Sudan warns more than 1 million children under the age of 5 will suffer from acute malnutrition in 2020. At the release of its State of the World's Children 2019 report in Juba today, a UNICEF official said the prevalence of acute malnutrition among South Sudanese children has increased from 13% in 2018 to 16% in 2019, which is above the 15% emergency threshold. Viola Elias has the rest of the story for VOA from Juba.
Andrea Sule, the UNICEF deputy country representative in South Sudan, says the agency's recent study found that children under the age of 5 are at the risk of physical consequences due to poor diet and contaminated food. The State of World Children 2019 report estimates that only 7% of South Sudanese children under the age of 5 have an adequate diet, while only half of households have access to clean drinking water and improved sanitation across the country. Sule says UNICEF and other aid agencies must prioritize preventing rather than treating malnutrition at this point.
Every child suffering from malnutrition today is a failure. It is a failure in preventing it from happening in the first place, because we know how to prevent it from happening. One thing clear to me is that UNICEF cannot do this alone. Driving this shift from treatment to prevention is an agenda that will save life and transform life, but it will only happen if we all play our part.
Dr. Samson Baba, special advisor to South Sudan Health Minister Ria Kogai, says South Sudan has been fighting a losing battle by concentrating on treating acute malnutrition without treating its root causes. Baba says he wonders why acute malnutrition levels are higher today than they were in the early 1980s, when South Sudan was poorer than it is today.
We know that 44% of the population of this country have access to the health facilities, and even the data we are talking about, the 56% of the population is not accessing, because we worked in the areas where there is health facility.
Baba says part of Upper Nile, Bahr el Ghazal, and the equatorial regions have no access to healthcare facilities due in large part to flooding. Brian Mindeja, UNICEF chief nutritionist, says UNICEF and other aid groups will work with all stakeholders to prevent children from becoming acutely malnourished.
So the children, when we see that they are...
Sometimes when we see them losing weight, we shouldn't wait for them to become malnourished. We should start acting by doing social behavior change communication. We need to act like that by working with their mothers to help avoid their children from becoming malnourished. I also think we need to move from health facilities and go to the communities.
The report recommends UNICEF and the UN Food and Agriculture Organization work to improve resilience by providing families with seeds and livestock to help prevent future shortages. The new report says about 340 million children globally suffer from deficiencies in vitamins and minerals such as iron and iodine that may later undermine their growth. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
Our thanks to Viola Elias for that report. Still on health news, the United Nations says about half of all children in Africa are not registered at birth, a lapse that prevents them from accessing essential social services, such as health and education. As Columbus Mavhunga reports from Zambia's capital, the UN says a number of African countries are working toward addressing this problem, but the countries say resources to make that a reality are scarce.
According to the United Nations, the problem of unregistered children in Africa is worse in rural areas where women give birth at home and don't bother to register the child with the government. Speaking on the sidelines of an ongoing conference of African ministers responsible for civil registration, Kambia Ma Gadio, the head of the UN in Zambia, said the problem makes it hard for such children to build prosperous lives.
If you are not registered at birth, you are not accounted for. Therefore, in many African countries, even access education systems, because to be registered in many schools, you need a birth certificate. And if you are not registered in education systems, you are missing a great opportunity to be educated, to get employment, and to be out of poverty.
Oliver Chinganya is the director of the African Statistics Center at the UN's Economic Commission for Africa, one of the agencies which organized the five-day conference in Lusaka together with the African Union. He says over the past 8 years, the UN has noticed a tremendous improvement in registration of African children at birth in 42 countries.
We have also noticed that 54% have actually nationalized their civil registration across the continent. We have also noticed that a number of countries, about 22% of the countries, have now been able to digitalize their national ID systems, which is a great improvement compared to pre-independence and even some 20 years ago.
Zambia is one of the countries that has digitalized their civil registration system. But Stephen Kambongo, Zambia's Minister of Home Affairs, says the Southern African nation and the rest of Africa still have a way to go.
Despite the progress that has been made in many countries, we still have this gap, identity gap, which is quite imminent. And this is so because of the historical background of where we're coming from and the geographic challenges that we have. We still have got rural parts of African member states are geographically challenged to access, and we are discussing ways and means of getting to address some of those challenges.
He said one solution might be mobile registration, where officials visit isolated places where there are no clinics, which makes it difficult for families to register their children. He said UNICEF is helping Lusaka to make that a reality. Columbus Mavhunga for VOA News, Lusaka, Zambia.
Some South Sudanese who have resettled in Canada have challenges understanding the laws of the country. A South Sudanese community member says most South Sudanese who found themselves on the wrong side of the law in Canada seek help when they are already in trouble with the police. In part two of our interview, James Swaka says some families did not seek the right advice when they arrived in Canada.
So one of the things that if you do not follow the right directions here, you fall into the wrong hand of the law. And once you get into that part of the system, it's very hard for you to come back from there because now you have a record. And that's tied to many things. If your record is not good in this country, you cannot get your citizenship, which means you're going to be in limbo for a while. And maybe your kids, if also they get the right direction, they're the ones who will be the ones who will really succeed, whereby you as a parent, you had that privilege or option to do that, but you couldn't because you didn't know how to get about it. So these are simple stuff, but they really have a very destructive ending to your success in this country. And these are simple things. If you have somebody that can kind of direct you, you get it right from the get-go. But if you didn't get anybody, then you're in trouble. We had people that came from Cuba years before we came here, and they fell through these pits. And most of them were deported just because they didn't know where to start by and where to ask for help and where to go. There are a lot of resources here, but we ourselves, Sudanese, are not tapping into these resources because we don't ask. We kind of ashamed to go and beg, per se. But really, it's not about begging, but it's actually equipping yourself with knowledge that can help you to move forward.
Yeah. And so let's talk about some of the challenges here. I mean, I've listened to people today who spoke to me about children who, after finishing their grade 12, end up working in factories and doing manual labor. Is this some of the things you talked through with parents when they first come here? Are you giving them lectures on what to do with their kids if they don't make the right choices?
Now, there are certain there are waves of South Sudanese that came into this country. Some of them came with kids that are already in higher educational levels. And there are some that are really still children. So one of the things that we have seen through all this process and time is that South Sudanese do not have a mentor, somebody that they can look up to and say, you know, this is somebody that I want to be like. Or even if there are these mentors around, there's this thing that a Junubi would think, okay, this is so-and-so, is from this region, I don't relate to him, so they don't even come to you. And these are obstacles. These are things that should have been things that will help a nation to grow. Even in this country, they don't see things as this is so and so and so. They see it as a national thing. If you help this person, it's for the benefit of the country. But we as Unibin don't see these things. And this is causing our downfall in this kind of environment where we say the diaspora are having issues with this. But these are small things that if we open our eyes to, would really encourage our youth, our small kids to grow beyond what we have already. Mm-hmm. And that's a major problem that we really need to see and recognize and try and rectify.
That's James Swaka, a South Sudanese Canadian and advisor to South Sudanese families who resettle in Canada, speaking with my colleague John Tanza in Kitchener, Waterloo. Tomorrow, Swaka talks about where to get help for mental health issues for South Sudanese in Canada. And that's our show for this Tuesday. We leave you with the song Tarazina by Setona. Listening to Setona with the song Tarazina. I'm Ayan Dangbior in Washington. Thanks for being here, and we hope you join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
ياكل قوان جبه سمسم بيجي في كرتون ياكل لهم بتعدان وساقة بتعرب وعنينا هنا كنا في بلد بتاعنا بياكل قوان جبه سمسم يجي في كرتون ياكل لهم بتعدان وساقة بتعرب وأنا مرق سيرة ده في اليوم التنيني شوفني أنا أقول راجلي وانتهت وصر بروسه وتلجي بلاي فتور.